Hello and welcome to episode 2 of A Blank Canvas. Oh my God. The reaction to the first episode has been amazing. I've had so many great comments about everything to do with it. Some very good constructive criticism also. It's just been amazing. I'm really grateful to everyone that's listened. The numbers are pretty high as well, I must admit. Without revealing too much, I'm very, very happy with the amount of people that have listened. The drummer, Woody, from the band. I'm lucky enough that I've DJed with him before in Manchester at Antwerp Mansion, and we had a great, great night drinking a shit ton of Buckfast. At the time, I didn't even know what Buckfast was. He was like, oh, can you please sort me some Bucky out before I DJ? I was like, what's Bucky? Someone tell me what Bucky is, please. And I found out, and Buckfast is great. I mean, it's like a sort of treacly alcoholic drink if you've never had it before. If you've never had it before, if you're going to have it, make sure you intend to stay up a while because it's full of sugar. It's ridiculous. This is me and Chris Wood, Woody from Bastille, talking about some real good stuff. Enjoy.
Welcome to A Blank Canvas with Cameron Ross.
Woody, to start things off, I'm going to give you a massive ego boost here. So, you're in a band that has had 2 number one albums, 9 top 40 singles, 4 top 10 singles, and 20 million monthly listeners on Spotify. So when you're walking down the street, do you have like a different kind of walk to everyone else? Because, you know, I mean, the number's right there.
I mean, my walk has kind of changed of late because I'm generally stooping trying to grab a 2-year-old from running into the road. but prior to that, I probably have my head held quite high.
How does that make you feel? Those numbers are just, they're incredible.
It's nuts, but also like we, how do I articulate it? Basically when it, so like there's 2 sides to it. So one, when we first like sort of blew up and everyone became aware of us, we've been going for like 2 or 3 years at that point. So what felt like an overnight thing for some people was kind of like a very sort of slow, steady build.
Well, that's it. A lot of people seem to think that when a band or artist or DJ has a number one single or a big record, they think, wow, that's an overnight success. When in reality, 99% of the time, it's not really an overnight success, is it?
No, not at all. And so, yeah, those numbers are I genuinely, it will sound like a lie. Most of those numbers I don't look at. Obviously, the number one albums, they meant a hell of a lot to us. I try not to look on the Spotify stuff or go look in the comments on YouTube or that sort of stuff, because it can be a pretty mucky place quite early on.
I can imagine YouTube comments can be pretty west to read, especially given as a musician or anyone in like a creative field. I mean, personally, I take, you know, someone, 20 people could say to me, wow, what a great DJ set or something like that. But then all it takes is one little dickhead to say, you were shit. And that's what sticks in my head. They're in my head, living rent-free in my head the whole time.
But you say that though, but then I always say that I think the worst response to anything you do is like a shoulder shrug or like just meh. Like I'd much rather someone hated it because it probably means somebody else is going to love it. You know what I mean?
That is true.
If it's just middle of the road, meh, then must try harder. Yeah, I'd rather someone absolutely hated it.
No, that's fair. I want to talk about how, because I'm always curious about how someone got into the creative field they're in. So in your case, did you always want to be a drummer? Did you pick up a guitar first and then start drumming? What was the process to you becoming a drummer?
I did actually pick up a guitar first when I was in like year 4.
that was a wild guess, by the way.
Oh, mate, yeah, well, you just get me, you know? You really get me. but the guitar, I was in year 4, so what, I've been like 8 or something? But the teacher was just trying to teach me Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and that sort of thing. I was like, I don't want to do this. This is rubbish. Like, I know I look like I'm 4, but yeah, I'm really not. So that put me off a little bit, but my dad still is a singer and guitarist around Plymouth, where I grew up. It's my hometown. So I grew up around bands from a very young age, and foolishly and wrongly, I thought that if you learned to play drums, you didn't have to learn to read music, which subsequently turned out to be a complete falsehood. So yeah, that was a bit of a hard lesson learned down the line. So yeah, I mean, from the age of 11 when I first picked up a pair of sticks properly and had lessons, and I did the usual thing of going through school, you know, you'd play in wind bands and orchestras and awful school bands, which we thought we sounded like absolutely epic, but it must have sounded like a cat getting fed through a tumble dryer or something. It would have been horrible. always kind of kept on doing it. And something that my dad kind of mentions now and then is like with schoolwork, I had to basically have a massive kick up the ass the whole time just to go and do anything. But with the drums and stuff, like, they never had to ask me once to go and practice. Like, I was doing stuff like a couple hours a night.
Did you fall in love with drumming straight away then? Did you have someone, obviously you've mentioned your dad, did you have a musician or band out there and you were like, okay, I want to be like that guy or be like that person?
Yeah.
Or did you just love drumming?
I'd have a few probably. So the initial one would have been Chad Smith, probably from the Chili Peppers. He's still an absolute monster. Like, just his feel and everything. Also, if you go on his Wikipedia, his credits list is insane. He's played on like thousands of albums for other people as well. He's just like so tasteful. But I'd probably say now, ultimately, I'd probably say like Dave Grohl, just because his musicality is insane. And I would say he makes non-drummers want to air drum with his parts. It's like his bits are actually musical. They add to the song, whereas you get some guys who are insanely fast, but it just sounds like white noise garbage.
Have you ever met Dave Grohl before?
I've not, no. And I don't know, if I had a chance to, I guess I'd like to, but I'd rather it was kind of like organically, if like you're in the
same room
with someone, rather than like go up to them like, oh, I love you, everything you've done.
So speaking of, you know, your love for Chad Smith, like, is there a track out there or an album that you would have loved to have worked on, one that's already been released, that you listen yourself and go, oh God, I'd love to have been a part in the creative process of that?
Yeah, probably the, well, there's a load, but I fucking love Song for the Dead off Queens of the Stone Age's Songs for the Deaf album, like track four. It's basically just Dave Grohl just absolutely having it. So yeah, probably that or something like, what's a good one? Oh, there's so many, man. There's so many. Like, I think there's two kinds of drummers. There's the ones who just study and they go on showing my age, like YouTube wasn't around when I was 14. But yeah, the ones that just deep dive on YouTube and just trying to learn all these mad, like, linear patterns, and like, just, it's basically like an arms race almost. Like, who can play the fastest, most ridiculous thing in their bedroom. And it's always bedroom drummers, not playing with a band, because if you played any of that stuff on a gig, you get fired in 2 seconds. Like, what is this shit?
It's essentially impractical.
Exactly, yeah. It's just, utterly pointless. So the other kinds of drummers are the ones that spend more time playing along to records, which is what I was doing growing up. Like, so I'd play along to, the Chili Peppers, Muse, Queens of the Stone Age, Smashing Pumpkins, James Brown stuff, Jimi Hendrix. I mean, like, there's like the, like, as I said, they're like the really ubiquitous, obvious ones like Zeppelin and Beatles, and yeah, everyone did that. So it kind of goes without saying, but yeah, just kind of more learning to play music rather than play drums, if that makes sense.
What's one of your favourite tracks to play live with Bastille?
There's a few, actually. Probably, I say at the minute, and Christ knows I'm going to get to do it again, but at the minute it's probably title track from the last album, Doom Days. Just kind of, yeah, looks at, but it's basically like the sort of angriest and rantiest Dan's ever got on, and it's quite cool sort of trap beats in it as well. And yeah, it's just quite a quite an aggy sort of song, I suppose. But yeah, like you just feel really, really cool playing it.
When you're playing live, do you prefer to play a festival set where it's sort of, you know, you're the best of everything you've got in a smaller time period, or do you actually enjoy playing album tracks and going through and, you know, playing everything?
It's a mixture. Like, you need like a bit of variety, to be honest. So by the time, like bands ordinarily, when in non-COVID-y times, would be touring sort of all through the autumn and winter and spring, and then come summertime, that's festival season. So by the time you finish festival season, you're sick of doing the sort of festival greatest hits set, then you want to do some deeper cuts. And then by the time you finish like kind of touring season, you're then gagging to kind of go out and see new bands, meet new people, and kind of just have some different experiences. So I think variety is kind of key. So like, I haven't got a preference as such, but I think one without the other doesn't really work.
Had you already started? I don't know the sort of typical preparation times to play festivals as a band, but had you already started rehearsing and stuff for this summer's festival season, or was it way too? Is it usually closer to summertime when you do?
Well, we weren't actually booked for much this summer. Like, we had a handful of dates. This was going to be a year off anyway, which has now transpired to be an absolutely accidental genius move by our management. I'm sure they claim credit, and they've clearly got a crystal ball stashed somewhere. But so we hadn't started that. However, I do feel, well, there's two kind of sort of groups of people I feel really sorry for. It's ones of the established acts who would have already spent, because when you have festival season, the planning starts months and months in advance, so they would have already paid for designs for like stage stuff and like props and all that sort of thing, and probably had half of that built already. So there's this stuff just sat in a warehouse now or been destroyed that they're just wasting money on. But the ones I really feel for are the acts that this would have been their sort of breakout summer, where, because like people, like festivals is essentially kind of getting everyone to join the dots. Like, say they've maybe heard your tune like on a playlist or on the radio or whatever, but they never actually put the name or the face with it. And then festivals is often the place where like, oh, that's who does that song.
Yeah, I see. And yeah.
So I'm thinking someone like a Celeste or someone who, like, obviously she won Critics' Choice at the Brits. This would have been the summer she would have really kicked on, I imagine. And would have really connected.
That's interesting. Yeah. I never really thought of festivals like that, but thinking about it now in retrospect, that has happened so many times for me. It's like when I remember seeing the Naked and Famous at Leeds Fest years ago, and I'd heard one of their tracks, I think on FIFA. And I was like, oh shit, okay. That's these guys. Yeah, wow, this is, and same with Foster the People with Pumped Up Kicks as well. That was over the radio. And then I was like, because they were playing a very small tent at the time, despite the fact, a very small stage at the time, despite the fact that Pumped Up Kicks was played every other track on Radio 1. And I was like, again, yeah, so that's a very interesting thought that I don't think you have as...
Sorry, quite cross. Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned FIFA, because like, so even when the band started out early doors, and we started doing things like very early 2011, and for ages we were like on Facebook and whatever, and just you like try and rotate mates that you invite to gigs just to kind of keep the numbers up, and for ages of banging on, like, oh, come and check my band out, we're doing this, that, the other, blah, 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 blah. Even after we got signed, people weren't that bothered. The second we had a song on FIFA, like, my phone just exploded. It was like, oh, mate, suddenly made it. Have you?
Amazing.
Yeah, it's funny.
You know what? You've just helped me out there, because I was going to ask you, at what point did you think as a band, or you individually as a part of the band, thought, actually, I think we've made it here, you know? I think this is it. Was there ever a sort of point where it was kind of definitive, or was it so gradual that you didn't really notice it, or did the FIFA thing sort it for you?
FIFA was part of it. The one that always sticks in my head, which we talk about a lot, is when we did Leeds for the first, no, sorry, Reading, sorry, Reading first that weekend. Reading in 2012. So the album hadn't come out yet? No, album hadn't come out yet. But we had some singles out, and the first one was Overjoyed, which is this like, kind of quite like down tempo, sort of moody, like minimalist electronic-y ballad sort of thing. And, we came out and the tent absolutely rammed. It was like, okay, that's different. And then Dan started playing the first chords of that song, and like the whole place just screamed the words back at us. It's like, okay, something's going on then.
Is that a sort of hairs sticking up on the arms moment for you?
Yes, a little bit, yeah. Obviously, we're just like, fucking hell, what's this going on?
So in terms of playing all over the world, which you've done, is there any part of the world where the fans react so differently to seeing you as a band live, but also reacting to your music when they listen to it on Spotify or whatever, anything like that?
I'd say the most, well, if I pick out any country, then I'm going to get pilloried by 10 others for not saying them, but like our Polish fan base are just like off the chain. Like they,
I wasn't expecting that, to be honest.
Well, it's the only place where like we've ever had like the sort of One Direction experience where like there were like cars chasing us, like running red lights and stuff, trying to follow us back to the hotel, that sort of stuff.
Wow.
And also like I remember some earlier gigs there where ordinarily playing a venue, like maybe like the front half of the room is jumping around. But this was like front to back, everyone in the room was just jumping in sync. It was fucking nuts.
For me, I'd say, and it's probably for a lot of people as well, and I imagine you're probably going to guess what I'm going to say to this, but Pompeii is the track that I was like, okay, these guys aren't fucking about here kind of thing.
Yeah.
For you, is it the same or is there another track where you're like, okay, this is, because obviously I imagine it's different for you as a band member than it is for someone who's just a fan.
Yeah, I mean... It's like we also often get asked the question like, do you ever get bored of playing it? And it's like, absolutely not. I mean, that song changed our lives, and
is it euphoric to play? Is it? I imagine it's quite euphoric to play.
Yeah, I mean, it helps that like our biggest song is kind of quite like upbeat and positive, rather than like some sort of moody down tempo thing that's quite melancholy. So that helps. But yeah, I mean, you got to be absolutely dead inside and so jaded to like not enjoy like the response that song normally gets. So. And if we never have a bigger song than that, then I don't really care, to be honest, because we're still able to keep making and releasing music and people still seem to care, which is ideal. And yeah, I mean, it definitely opened up like a lot of doors for us a lot earlier than they might have been. So yeah, that song's an absolute life changer.
Surviving's a banger, by the way. I really like that. And the artwork's fucking cool as well. When, as a band, as Bastille, you collaborate with other artists, is it just Dan that collaborates, or are you all involved still?
It's Dan mostly. I mean, there's times where we get involved, but yeah, Dan is the writer, and obviously when it says like featuring Bastille, often it's his vocal. But yeah, there's times also that where we do get involved occasionally, but that's fine. I mean, that's his thing, and like we're all off doing our own little bits involved on the side as well, so. It's I think kind of having a little bit of space is probably quite healthy as well.
Oh, for sure. Is there any band that's around right now that you'd love to work with that you've not already got plans to work with? Or I mean, obviously without revealing anything in that case. But yeah, is there any bands that you?
There's nothing in the pipeline, as far as I'm aware. But I guess it's kind of like the ones that there's like a difference of like say bands you love versus like bands that you think would actually gel well. With you, or because I'm absolutely obsessed with Idols of late, but I can't really picture how they and us would meld in any sort of way. But I don't really know. I mean, to be honest, like, still the maddest thing we ever did was that Craig David single. I couldn't believe we're on stage with Craig David, who like when we grew up, he was like the biggest pop star in the country for a number of years, and yeah. Suddenly find yourselves in a Craig David video. Yeah, absolutely surreal. Craig's just like one of the nicest dudes you'll ever kind of happen across. And yeah, just fiercely creative. Also when we did the first gig with him, it was like at the Apple Music Festival a few years ago. I didn't realize he turned up. I was like, and we were just doing a sound check, getting our sort of levels on our ears and stuff. And all of a sudden, this like absolute voice, like silk, suddenly comes down. Danny, headphones. I was like, "My God!" Like Ben, our monitor engineer, is doing a really good impression. But I know Craig's here. That's why.
Right. Is there another artist or a celebrity who has approached you and been like, "I'm a huge fan," and you've been like, "You're a fan"? Like, wow. Okay, fair enough. Not to say that your music isn't great. I'm just saying, like, someone that you're surprised by.
So there's probably two we've had. Coachella, we had The Edge from U2 watching from the side of stage. And at the Singapore F1, we had Brian May of Queen. So yeah, two very unexpected observers, at least. Yeah, I mean, whether they're a fan or not, they're probably just checking out what's going on. But yeah, that was a little bit surprising.
Has there been any other sort of pinch yourself moments throughout your career so far?
Yeah, I mean, there's been loads, like the winning a Brit in 2014, even just dumb things like, well, I was gonna say dumb, like getting to visit NASA. That was insane. So, we got a tweet off, a guy called Jared, who's like an engineer and designer of re-entry parachutes for like space modules. And he got in touch. Wow. Oh, hey, like, wow. I see you near Houston. If you want to come and see NASA, then just give me a shout. And we were like, fuck yes. So we've now kind of got this like massive loving going on with NASA. So we've visited like different sites about two or three times now.
Wow.
So yeah, that's just nuts.
Is there, when you travel, well, when you did travel, hopefully you still will eventually.
In the good old days.
In the good old days, which is weird. I was talking to a friend earlier actually about how it was literally February this year, but it feels like, for me, it feels so much longer.
Yeah, I can't believe like 9 months normal. Ago, me, Will and Kyle and Eric, our tour manager, were floating off a beach in Western Australia just drinking cocktails. It feels like a very long time ago now.
Out of all the places you've been to, I imagine it's to be a very difficult question and probably quite a cliche question, but where is a place that you just fucking adore and you'd love to go back to time and time again?
I'd always say if I had to leave the country, I'd move to Berlin, like without question.
Berlin, wow, okay.
Yeah, there's just so much going on there. Such a cool place. People are great. Also helps that my wife's German as well. So, okay. Yeah, a little bit biased.
Again, can you speak any German?
Mein Deutsch ist schrecklich, which means it's rubbish. So, but now we've got the kids watching German cartoons in the mornings. So
what is that? Is that on German Netflix or something like that?
It's all manner of stuff like Disney Channel in German. But yeah, they don't complain. They sit there and watch it. So I'm assuming they understand what's going on. It's one of those places where you could go out every night and have a completely different night out every time without fail.
I'm very curious. You've been all over the world and you've said Berlin's one of your favorite places, and Poland is one of the best places in terms of, would you say in terms of performing live, it's one of the best places?
Yeah, I mean, but then like you can't even narrow it down by country. So like if you play anywhere off the beaten track a little bit, say for instance, like bands when they tour, they'll always go to LA, New York, London, Paris, what have you. So those, the people there are kind of spoiled and it's expected that they'll come. When you go to places that bands that ordinarily tour, then people often just lose their shit. So like Salt Lake City is always absolutely crazy. Like people there are nuts. So yeah, whether there's something in the water in Utah, I don't know, but, yeah, it's just, yeah. So I'd say it's less, but kind of even my country, just more like the sort of geography of the place. Not to the fact.
Do you remember where the last place you played live was as a band?
Yeah, it was the Palladium in London, actually, in Soho.
Oh wow!
So we did that for War Child. We've done this, done it a handful of times. Done these things called reorchestrated, which is like orchestral reworking of all our tunes.
You very generously invited me to, invited more. I DM'd you and said, can I please come to the Apollo one in Manchester?
Yes.
And that was a fantastic show. One of my friends saw you in London at, Albert Hall?
Yeah, we did Albert Hall on that tour as well, yeah.
And she was like, they're just fucking great. And it's a very... unique approach where would you put your music? Would you call it pop? Would you call it?
I mean, like we got kind of panned by the media and press because they didn't like that. They found it very tricky to kind of put us in a certain hole or a certain slot. So I mean, we kind of went with like cinematic indie pop for a bit, but it's evolving. To be honest, like
that's great. Actually, I like that.
We like so many genres. And we hop around, there's like hip hop influences, electronic, like big epic, stringsy stuff, out and out rock stuff, everything else in between. But we're lucky that Dan's voice is like so instantly recognizable that you just know it's us the second he kind of opens his gob.
Have the four of you known each other for a long time prior to Bastille? Or?
Yeah, well, so the band formed proper in like summer of 2010, but I was playing with Dan since like early 2008, I guess. And we picked up Will and Kyle along the way. So yeah, I mean, like, yeah, we kind of all knew each other like a good, like at least six to like 24 months before the band formed.
were you all from sort of different genres within music and you came together?
Completely.
And thought, yeah?
Completely, yeah. So like Dan's obviously quite a singer-songwriter in his sort of tastes, and but he's obsessed with like Kanye and production and that sort of stuff as well. But Kyle's into like real hard, well, at the time was into like real hard sort of trap stuff, and like he was always like well ahead of the curve on that sort of thing, like things that, like he was banging on about Harlem Shake like 18 months before that even blew up. And then Will's more is like your sort of traditional like jazzy, funky, blues sort of guy. And then I'm just your, I don't know, like idiot rocker just trying to snap my drum kit into.
So is that the kind of stuff you listen to then? You'd listen to a lot of rock yourself, or do you sort of pan out and listen to some dance music every now and then?
I listen to all sorts, to be honest. Like I like everything from Slipknot to Britney Spears. So,
right, okay.
Yeah. And if it was in between, but, yeah, I mean, I just, it sounds like the most, like non-committal answer, but yeah, I like good music. Like if it's good, it's good. I don't really care about the genre. Except for country and western, that can jog on. That leaves me cold. And not into that.
What about some of Taylor Swift's earlier stuff?
I mean, fine. if you like that sort of thing.
As a band, you've obviously just you just. I mean, it's you're obviously smashing it, and more so you with your smashing your drum set and whatever. I had the pleasure of DJing with you.
I want to say 3 years ago, I think.
Was it three years ago? I think it was. I think it was a Freshers Week. Was it a Freshers Week or was it like Christmas time?
It was cold. I remember that. It was Antwerp Mansions, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, well, I remembered. It was a. How many, have you done many DJ sets? Was that quite? I'm hoping that it was up there for you as one of your favorite DJ sets.
It was. I learned a lot that night because.
In terms of
obviously I know from previous experience, like I mean, like I used to play in wedding bands way back in the day to pay rent, so obviously you've got to play to the crowd, and yeah, I thought I had it figured out, and then I ended up having to basically completely go off on a sort of tangent, like rapidly going through my files trying to find some songs that these lot would actually like. But yeah, even songs like I didn't expect to be like absolute bangers, just because that kind of completely went off. What's his face? Jamie T, like that sort of stuff.
Oh, Sticks and Stones.
Yeah.
Is it Sheila?
Yeah. Well, I think I did Sticks and Stones, yeah. And yeah, everyone seems to love that. Yeah, just in terms of kind of, and also like the sort of stuff you were doing, obviously mixing like a whole load of like rock, pop, indie, old school, and like current stuff. Rather than, because I think, I mean, like DJing is definitely not easy, but I think if you're doing just like a house set, it's like, well, all your songs are going to be within a certain like 10 BPM.
Yeah, range. Yeah.
Like it's not hard. Whereas like with indie stuff, obviously you got to really think your transitions through and crowbar bits.
Well, with indie stuff, there's no like intro or outro, is there? I mean, a lot of the time, the vocals come straight in after 5 seconds, or and there's no like. It's, I mean, obviously the BPMs vary massively from. For Telly's Chelsea Dagger or what's the other tune by the Fratellis? I've forgotten it.
I know exactly what you mean.
But it's all fast paced, and then you can go to a Midnight City by M83, which is pretty slow. But that is a banger to play for some club nights. Midnight City.
I also realised that with some things, like just because you can, you shouldn't. Like I thought I was really clever that I figured out. Basically, I took the Hives, Hate to Say I Told You So, and that's not done to a click. But then I put the middle section where it breaks down to the bass line, I put that in Logic, and I snapped it all to the grid, time stretched it, so just so I could loop it underneath Drake's Hotline Bling. And I thought that was really clever, but like no one gave two fucks. Like, okay, right.
That's the thing though. It's like a lot of the time I can be prepared to DJ at a university or something, and I'm in the hotel before and I'm planning like, okay, this track and this track is going to go well, it's going to go together so well, sounds so sweet, it's going to go off, and then play it and just people are just not arsed. It's a complete waste of time.
Yeah. And also like songs that previously, even like 5 years ago, maybe like you would have played them, would have been an absolute banger. Like a block party tune or something. I know, but then I tried it on a Freshers gig and just like stony silence, tumbleweeds crashing through, like no one cared. I was like, okay.
Well, I mean, is that to do with the fact that Bloc Party haven't released anything recently? Essentially, because, you know, I mean, people who were going to university last year or even not this year were born in 2001, 2002. I mean, yeah. that's crazy.
I guess,
to think.
But then, I guess in my head, I thought they like say like Banquet or something like the Bloc Party, and I thought that was like as much of a classic as say like Sex on Fire or Mr. Brightside, which came out like around the same sort of time. But so obviously, like those songs have aged well, and everyone knows them, and they'll still go mad for those.
But, well, I mean, it's the argument of Mr. Brightside is it's a funny one because people, it's such a cliche thing to say, but it is like Marmite in the sense that people love it, either love it or they're like, oh God, Mr. Brightside.
I'm going to the bar.
Go to the bar, yeah. I remember when we were at Antwerp, we were drinking Buckfast. Have you been sponsored by Buckfast yet?
I should be. My best man for my birthday got me a Buckfast hoodie that he ordered from some like dodgy website.
Oh, was this? I think I saw this on your Instagram. Was it like a hoodie or a onesie? Was it a onesie?
No, it's a hoodie.
Is it? Okay.
I mean, I'd love a onesie. Yeah, Bucky's just kind of like Bucky was our sort of secret weapon on our rider because it's really good for like combating jet lag because it's got a ton of caffeine in it and obviously booze. So if you're kind of not quite sure which way's up, when you get off a plane, like on a savagely different time zone, straight to a festival, have a little bit of that, it can kind of wake up a little bit and get you in the mood.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've got it all worked out with that. With everything that's going on as a musician yourself, how are you feeling with about everything? How are you coping? Are you just hanging out yourself with playing drums or?
Oh, mate, I wish. I've got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. So it's just absolute carnage every day. it's fine. I mean, like we're not in a bad position, and my missus thankfully has got a proper job. So we're not in big trouble.
I love that. I love the phrase proper job.
Yeah, well, bloody need one now. Christ, yeah. Like my Mickey Mouse operation is not happening anytime soon, by all accounts. Nor is it deemed viable by the government, apparently. So, which is nice. So
I'm sure their kids are right now probably listening to Bastille on Spotify whilst their dad's saying, oh yeah, it's not viable, however.
Yeah, get a proper job. Now, I mean, I would say that, I've been doing bits of bobs, so I've done some recording for like other people as well. Unfortunately, I've got like a home studio, which sounds pretty decent. So I've done some stuff. So there's a guy called Honor who supported us on tour, January last year, and he did this song with Nile Rodgers called Kill TV. So I ended up playing drums on that. Like, so there's drums recorded basically in my garden shed, which has now got Nile Rodgers playing on top of it.
Oh wow,
which is really weird. Just been doing bits of that, and I've also, because I've clearly lost my mind, I've also started a record label as well, called Dumond Records. So it's kind of an independent one, and we've got an artist who we've been kind of working with for a little while now called Ulysses Wells, who we're really into, and we're kind of pushing out EPs and stuff of his at the minute. So yeah, I mean, I'm definitely staying busy.
What kind of sound is he?
It's kind of like I guess in the vein of like a UK Jack White, but like we're kind of scuzzy sort of glitch guitars and a bit more hip hop influences, and he's just great, super super creative.
Speaking of you playing drums in your garden on a track also played on by Nile Rodgers, is there anything else out there that you've played on that isn't sort of not public knowledge per se, but you've not sort of advertised it?
There's several things, but they're not released yet. So
okay,
I'm probably not at liberty to even say they exist because some of them might not see the light of day, and some will. But yeah, so the answer is yes. I wish I could tell you which ones.
No, that's fair enough. Woody, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure,
it's been really good talking to you.
Likewise,
yeah, thank you very much. I wish you the best of luck with a proper job.
Yeah, mate. Well, yeah. Full-time house husband now, pretty much.
Well, that was fun. Thank you very much for listening to episode 2. There's so much more coming up, I promise you. Episode 3, episode 4, episode 5. I've got so many great guests booked in, and I can't wait to share it all with you. Every Wednesday from 8 p.m, Spotify, A Blank Canvas, Apple Podcasts, A Blank Canvas, Amazon Music, A Blank Canvas. We're on all social media at A Blank Canvas Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Drop us a like, a follow. Thank you very much for the support. Share, tell your friends. Have a great week. Have a great weekend.